From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Robert Siegel, and now a young pianist from Pasadena. His name is Mark Yu. His parents are from China, and he spends a lot of time there. This week, he went to a Los Angeles studio, and he played this Chopin mazurka for us. I met Mark Yu at a fundraising event in Washington, D.C. several weeks ago. It was for victims of the Sichuan earthquake. By coincidence, I was planning to interview his idol this week, the pianist Lang Lang. They're going to play together next month in London, so I thought I'd interview him too. Here's what's so interesting about Mark Yu. He's 9 years old.
My legs are long enough for the pedal, but still my legs aren't straight. Sometimes your legs have to be straight for a pedal, but mine is like slanted for a pedal. But I sometimes have to sit close to a piano or stretch my legs. My left hand can reach an octave, not fast. My right hand, not yet.
So you can stretch over 8 notes with your left hand, but, well, obviously you'll pretty soon have a longer reach than that. I mean, it's just a matter of growing into the piano, huh?
Yeah.
You know, you're now 9 years old. When did you start playing the piano? How old were you when you began?
I can vaguely remember it, but through all the numerous retelling through my mom, I was 2. I was at a friend's party where there were some children singing Mary Had a Little Lamb. So I jumped on their piano and started playing out the tune. But I can remember very well my recital debut when I was 3 playing a G major sonatina by Beethoven.
And when did you decide that you wanted to be a concert pianist?
When I was 3, I asked my mom if I could become a pianist. And I started taking lessons from my mom and then lessons from a teacher.
And how much do you practice in order to be a concert pianist?
Oh, from 0 to 8 hours per day. It really depends whether if I'm traveling or I'm at home, even if I'm in the mood for it.
0 to 8 hours, that's a very big spread. So I assume that if you do 0 one day, it won't be 0 the next day. How many days off can you take from practicing in a row?
1.
The next day you'll be practicing again.
Yeah. Practice makes perfect. You don't want a Beethoven piece to sound like something else that's disrespectful to the composer.
And do you also have to do other schoolwork during the day? Are you going to a regular school or do you have a tutor? How does that work?
My mom actually homeschools me and I have a lot of time to play and I have many friends whom I play with. Mm-hmm. I think other kids are missing out because they're confined with school 5 days a week and 7 hours per day.
Well, I want you to tell me a little bit about what's going to happen in August when you play at the Proms in London, the famous Promenade concerts. You're going to play a duet, I gather, with Lang Lang.
Yes, I'm going to play a four-handed piece with Lang Lang by Schubert.
Playing with Lang Lang sounds like it's going to be very exciting at the Proms in London.
Yes, I'm very excited. It's like winning a lottery or like dining with the muses or other gods.
He's a hero of yours,
so
Lang Lang.
So exciting.
Yes?
Yeah.
How do you explain to people your gift for this? Why do you think you have this talent? Where does it come from?
I have to thank my mom for that because even though when I was still an embryo in our tummy, she would play music from famous pianists on the CD or she herself would sing tunes, nursery rhymes, or play some Beethoven for me.
Well, when you performed in Washington at the fundraising event for victims of the Sichuan earthquake, you chose a piece by Chopin to play, and I'd like you to explain why you played that piece, and then if you could to play it for us.
Sure, I will play it. Well, I'll tell you why I chose that piece first.
Okay.
because Chopin wrote that piece for the victims of the Polish-Russian War. That's why I played that piece for the Chinese victims in the earthquake tragedy. Yeah.
Chopin's Nocturne in C-sharp minor, played by 9-year-old pianist Mark Yu. You can hear more of his playing at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Deborah Amos. In your health today, ever wish you could get a house call from a doctor? In the Netherlands, you can, any evening or weekend. NPR's Patty Naiman went to the Netherlands as part of our series on healthcare in Europe. Patty, why did you focus on after-hours care?
Well, Deb, we're looking at countries that insure everybody and still spend less on healthcare than we do here in the U.S. One might expect that having doctors do house calls nights and evenings and weekends for everyone would be something no country could afford, but not so.
Okay, so how do they do it?
Well, it turns out that getting sick and being treated by a primary care doctor even after hours is a cost saver. The important word here is primary care doctor. In the U.S., some of these doctors do house calls, but the main place where people go to get care after hours and on the weekends is often the hospital emergency room. Now, that's partly because many people are uninsured and they don't even have a family doctor. But the emergency room is an expensive place to get medical care. So in the Netherlands, every neighborhood has what they call an after-hours clinic or post. And I spent one evening with doctors who work in one low-income neighborhood in Amsterdam.
All right, so let's hear what it's like.
Goedenavond, u spreekt met de huisartsenpostassistent.
It's early evening, 6 o'clock, and things are beginning to bustle. A couple of doctors gulp down dinner. A paramedic checks his medical bag for supplies. And Lita Vandenberg begins to field phone calls.
En wat is de geboortedatum?
Ja. Vandenberg is a physician's assistant trained to figure out when patients can stay home and when they need to come into the clinic. She offers a variety of advice for things like ointments for rashes, what to expect with an ankle strain, whether a fever is serious or not. And sometimes she'll tell patients to come on into the clinic. On this night, they'll see Dr. Nora Bartelsmann, the family doctor on duty.
And what do I have? Children with fevers, backaches, skin rashes, infected eyes, bladder infections, anything. The more serious situations, we'll visit patients in their homes. And what would be serious? Just a moment, please. Oh, my colleague has two house calls at the moment.
Bartelsmann's colleague, Dr. Pascal Pock, has just received word that a patient who needs care is bedridden and can't come to the clinic. The patient's son is on the phone.
They can't really judge the situation. He just says that his father can't get out of his bed anymore, and he can't tell any more details. So we just have to go and have a look what's going on.
So Pock and her partner, Gerard Cowell, a paramedic who also drives the car, head out. Even their transportation is geared to primary care. They drive around in what looks like a half ambulance, half taxi. It's a small Audi painted bright yellow and blue with a siren stashed inside that can be put on top of the car if need be. They have some medical gear, but not a lot. As they drive to the patient's home, another call comes in.
Hello?
Hello, met Regine.
Ja, zeg maar.
About 5 minutes later, Pack and Cowell arrive at the first patient's home.
Hello.
Ushered in, Pack heads up a steep, narrow staircase. At the top, there are two tiny bedrooms with twin beds. In one room, a frail man lies in a sort of fetal position. His son wrings his hands. He explains to the doctor that his father is 91 years old and unusually listless. He won't get out of bed, not even to help his elderly wife, who he usually cares for. She's quite sick, too, and in bed in the next room. Dr. Pock begins her exam.
Hallo, wat is er met u aan de hand?
Ja, wist ik het was.
Wist u het maar, vertel eens. Heeft u ergens last van? Waarom ligt u nou in bed?
Pock coaxes the man to sit up, takes his blood pressure, taps gently on his belly.
Even naar uw buik kijken hoor, meneer.
Pock decides this is not heart failure, even though the patient's calves and face are really swollen. She gives him an injection to relieve the fluid buildup and then gives the son a prescription for more diuretics and tells him to check in with the doctors in the morning. The son agrees, thanks the doctor, and then it's off to the second house call. This is an assisted living facility. It's bright and clean, particularly in contrast to the first house. This patient is also elderly, but he's up and about. His wife answers the door. They speak with Dr. Pock, and the patient describes abdominal pain that has now subsided. Pock decides to do an exam anyway. The patient's a little embarrassed that the doctor came here and the pain is gone, but the doctor says better safe than sorry. She suggests the patient had a hernia that retreated. After cordial goodbyes, it's on to the next patient, a terminally ill man with prostate cancer who is vomiting from chemotherapy. Pock gives his wife a prescription for anti-nausea medication. There's not much more she can do. Back at the clinic, Pock enters her notes about her treatment of each patient into their electronic medical records. Just like their family physicians, she has access to all the information about these patients and can pass along what happened this evening. A seamless communication system. Pock's about to settle in, but she gets a call about another patient, an elderly, diabetic woman who's disoriented and dizzy. This could be serious. Pock nearly runs to the car and gets to the patient's home within 10 minutes. The patient's son, Rudolf Haymeyer, is amazed at how quickly she got there.
I was still hanging on the phone. There was a miscommunication with the operator. I was waiting for an answer of the doctor will come. Then the doctor was here and I was still hanging on the phone.
This is the longest visit of the evening so far. Pock talks with the patient, her two sons, her husband, examines her and decides the patient must go to the hospital. Pak calls an ambulance and leaves the son in charge. Of the six patients she's seen tonight, this is the only one she admits to the hospital.
Well, I do think house calls are very good to have because, as you could see, that several people who were quite ill, who weren't really able to come on them with their own transport to a GP or a hospital or whatever, I could still manage to keep at home.
A more comfortable situation for the patient, says Pak, and a lot less costly for the healthcare system.
The cost of an ambulance is already very high, and as soon as you're in a hospital, you have to do a certain amount of tests, which we don't do. And very often you can keep people at home, and especially if they're very ill or terminally ill, I think it's much more patient-friendly and also better for your budget.
And for those patients who were able to travel to the clinic and see Dr. Noral Bartelsmann, it's still a cheaper option than a hospital ER. While Dr. Pak was out on house calls, Bartelsmann saw about 30 patients in the clinic.
Anxiousness is always a good reason to see someone. If parents are worried about a sick child, we let them come. If they have symptoms that haven't been going away, we let them come. If they have things that we think need to be seen, and especially on Friday evening, it's a long wait until their doctor's back again on Monday. So we'd rather see them now than wait till Monday to see their own doctor when they could have been treated much earlier.
Across the Netherlands, there are about 120 after-hours clinics like this one, and over 90% of the Dutch population has access to them. Patty Neiman, NPR News.
You can get a big picture view of how the Netherlands healthcare system stacks up against other European countries and America at npr.org/yourhealth.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. This summer, as usual, high school graduates are searching for dorm room bedsheets or laptops for college. Others are getting their passports in order to head off on a kind of sabbatical. A growing number of students are taking what's called a gap year after they've been accepted into college, as NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
As a self-described perfectionist at one of the best prep schools around Boston, James Clark didn't really surprise anyone when he got into a bunch of top colleges. What was surprising was when he wrote back to his first choice saying he wasn't coming, at least for now.
I mean, unless I turn out to be a rock and roll star or something like that, you know, I'll never have time to do whatever you want. And so I knew that I had to seize this opportunity, so.
Clark says he desperately needed time to get out of his books, as he puts it, and into the real world. So instead of hanging his corkboard in his freshman dorm, he's off this fall to do field research in the Tibetan mountains, martial arts in Tiananmen Square, and scuba diving somewhere in South America.
Here we go, the famous whale shark.
Clark says he can't wait to do what he wants without worrying what colleges will think, like he always had to do in high school.
You can't just say, oh, you know, this is what I want to do. I revise in my head, you know, saying, is this right? I want to do things a little bit differently than I have been doing them.
You want to loosen up a little.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I want to unwind.
Gap years have long been popular in Europe. In the U.S., there's no hard national data, but colleges, consultants, and travel abroad programs all say more kids are doing it. At Swarthmore, the number doubled this year. Dean of Admissions Jim Bach says he thinks overscheduled and overachieving kids are trying to reclaim the downtime that used to come naturally.
Summers have disappeared completely, sadly, because so many are doing things which they think will look good on a college application. And so I actually would say that gap year may be the new summer.
For some kids, the gap year means time to pursue a long-time passion. For others, like Nicola Rentschler, it's about pushing yourself into new territory. Never an animal person, she signed up to rehab wild penguins in South Africa.
You have to, like, wrangle them, you have to hold them, they bite, they claw. You'd be surprised how many ways they can actually hurt you. It was sort of a confidence thing because they had to push myself completely out of my comfort zone. So
gap years vary in cost. Many kids work first at home to save the few thousand dollars they may need to teach English in Peru for a few months or help a beekeeper in France. Some parents are happy to foot the bill for that rather than let a kid who's not ready for college waste a full year's tuition. Schools say kids come back from gap years much more mature, ready to learn, and self-sufficient than they ever were when they graduated high school.
A lot of these kids are coming out with only one set of skills, and that is how to be a good student. You know, they need to sort of see that that doesn't really give you life skills.
Gail Reardon, a consultant with Taking Off, helps kids plan their gap years.
Hello.
Hi, Georgina.
Hello.
How are you?
Reardon's business has more than tripled in the last few years as more kids take gap years and need help making it happen.
I really like the dolphin and turtle research in Mozambique.
Okay. Let me just ask you a question. Have you ever scuba dived?
No.
Okay, so before we get too far along...
Reardon likes to say gap years are about letting kids make their mistakes before their mistakes really count. But as gap year consultants and programs proliferate, consultant Stephen Roy Goodman says not all of them give kids that chance.
If everything is taken care of for a student, that does defeat some of the purpose of why we're engaged in this in the first place.
Others worry that gap year programs will become the exclusive province of upper middle class kids who already head to college with many advantages. Gap years tend to be more common with wealthier kids looking for the kind of grittier real world challenges that Johns Hopkins professor Stephanie DeLuca says other kids can't avoid.
For, you know, the other end of the socioeconomic spectrum, the gap year, it's not called the gap year, you know, it's just called life.
Colleges say a gap year doesn't have to be costly. Students could intern with a state representative or work in a national service program. But the concern was enough that Princeton University is planning to actually subsidize students who spend a year doing public service. It's hoping to convince 10% of freshmen to take a year off before starting college. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
Here's a word that may have come up at the religious summit in Madrid, and that word is jihad. It's a word that's found its way into popular media.
Jihadists are pretending to be Americans.
Pakistan has become jihad central.
And that he wanted to wage a jihad, or act of holy war, against civilians.
It's a hot war all the same, on a battlefield called jihad.com.
The Bush administration has decided to rethink the way the U.S. government uses the word jihad. It's a recognition that in the Muslim world, the meaning is a bit more complicated than holy war or terrorism. NPR's Jamie Tarabay has this report.
It's not just in the news media the word pops up in a violent context. Here's a recent scene from the show Desperate Housewives. One of the housewives, Lynette, is in her yard trying to root out a possum with a pellet gun. Her husband is horrified.
Lynette, I think you should come inside and lie down for a little while.
No way. He's here, Tom. I can tell.
Okay. Now you're scaring me.
Why?
Look at yourself. You've declared jihad on a possum.
I laughed, but it was like, oh, great.
That's singer-songwriter Annie Zonveld. It was at that moment, she says, she realized just how entrenched the idea of jihad equaling violence was.
If Hollywood takes that meaning the way, in the sense of violence, it's just about over. It's over. Game's over.
But it may not be game over just yet. After all this time, the Bush administration has realized the word has very positive connotations to Muslims, and officials should stop using it.
It's like saying thank you. It's like a very positive thing to call somebody.
Duncan McGuinness is a spokesman for the State Department's Counterterrorism Communication Center.
Just like you wouldn't call Joseph Stalin hero of the revolution and people's savior or whatever, you know, you don't want to call bin Laden a jihadist. He loves it.
The center put out a memo in January, similar to that issued previously by the British government. It advises employees to stop using Islamic references whenever they condemn terrorists.
Our vocabulary has to work in ways that don't reinforce the message that bin Laden and Zawahiri and others are trying to promote.
So what does it actually mean? Jihad is considered to be a religious duty, a struggle, what's called striving in the path of God. A quest to quit smoking or drinking can be a jihad. So is resisting an occupying force or fighting someone who's preventing you from practicing your religion. Muhammad Majid is imam of Adams Center, a collective of 7 mosques in Virginia. He says when officials criticize jihad, they offend Muslims.
You isolate so many people by using that. We need to discredit terrorism.
But critics of the policy change argue the West had it right. Tawfiq Hamid is known for once belonging to Egypt's Jamaa Islamiyah, considered a terrorist organization by the US and other governments. He's now an outspoken critic of Islamic fundamentalism. He says some Islamic legal books continue to define jihad in its most violent context.
So what I'm saying is that when these books change the meaning of jihad into a pure, peaceful meaning and stop the other violent ones, then and only then the Western countries should say jihad is only peaceful.
Meanwhile, other Muslims are trying to show that jihad can be peaceful.
The jihad is not a holy war. It's a struggle. And love jihad is a struggle with the self.
That's from a documentary by Pervez Sharma, an Indian who spent 6 years in 12 different countries filming gay and lesbian Muslims. He called the film A Jihad for Love.
For me, it's a really powerful tool, if you will, and a very conscious, deliberate political tool to take that word back and to apply it in the context of Islam's most unlikely storytellers, which are gay and lesbian Muslims.
He sees jihad as a Muslim's internal struggle to become a better person.
Allah will help those who help themselves.
And then there's Annie Zonfeld. Her song is called Ummah Wake Up.
People of the world, no matter who you are.
Ummah means community. And I use a song as a way to encourage people to do the right thing and to have that jihad to do the right thing.
When she performs the song, often in mixed faith gatherings, the response isn't always enthusiastic.
People cringe. I can see that when they're sitting down and they're still cringe at the word jihad. But once I start singing and then once they really understand what it means, then they actually, you know, clap along and sing along.
Zonveld says she'll keep singing her songs until there's less cringing and more clapping. Jamie Tarabay, NPR News.
Allah will help those who help themselves. Don't waste time and wonder why the sufferings we have. People of the world, no matter who you are, look beyond our differences, that way we'll...
In Russia, domestic violence is a silent crisis. According to government estimates, one Russian woman dies at the hands of her husband or partner every hour. But Russians don't talk much about domestic violence. Even the police don't consider it a crime. NPR's Moscow correspondent Gregory Pfeiffer reports.
Elena Litvin married a medical student in 1995, expecting to begin a happy family life. She had 2 children, but says her marriage soon became a nightmare.
My husband began staying out late drinking. He'd come home angry and beat me in front of the children. He'd hit me in sensitive areas such as the stomach and chest, avoiding my face and hands so the marks couldn't be seen in public.
Litvin says her husband threatened to kill her. She was desperate, but too afraid to complain. That's hardly unique in a country where victims of domestic abuse often have nowhere to turn. In Moscow, a city of more than 10 million people, there's not a single shelter for battered women. Even at this shelter outside Moscow, there are only 7 beds. It's one of only 20 government-run shelters in the entire country. Director Marina Nikitina downplays the issue of domestic violence. She says domestic abuse is no worse in Russia than anywhere else. Others disagree. Even the government's own figures estimate 14,000 women die each year from domestic violence. That's about 1 every hour. It's more than 10 times the number of deaths in the United States, which has twice Russia's population. Experts say there are signs the government is starting to take action against domestic violence. But they say the real number of victims is impossible to count because domestic violence is hidden away, seen as a private matter not to be aired in public. Russian law doesn't recognize domestic violence as a crime. Marina Pisklakova, director of the ANA Center for Domestic Violence, says even authorities willing to intervene in abuse cases often can't act until it's too late.
It's very difficult for them to do their job. They all know that until the injuries are medium, severe, or murder occurs, they cannot intervene.
Pisklakova says that to be classified as a medium case, an injury has to prevent someone from being able to work for 2 weeks. Even women able to prove they're victims of domestic violence often face insurmountable obstacles in a legal system in which restraining orders don't exist. Many women who file complaints against their partners end up retracting them. Elena Litvin finally gathered the courage to go to the authorities, but she says the police initially refused to investigate her claims. It took them 6 months to start criminal proceedings against her husband. Litvin finally divorced him in 2004. But like many estranged Russian couples, they couldn't afford to move apart and continue to live together, which she says is seriously harming their young children.
They tell me it's difficult to bear his presence. He gets drunk and follows us around, finding fault with every word we say. His goal is to humiliate us.
Marina Pisklakova says domestic abuse is common in patriarchal societies such as Russia's, where violence is often justified as a way of controlling women, and where an old saying advises, if he beats you, he loves you.
She must have done something wrong to deserve it. That mentality is still there. The mentality of women being basically created to serve men, that mentality is still there in many ways.
One survey found more than half of women questioned said they'd been beaten by their husbands. Pisklakova says many Russians believe domestic violence to be acceptable in a society that sees itself as emotional and passionate, and where the impetuous Russian soul is invoked to explain away what's seen as violent crimes of passion. Elena Litvin says even though her ex-husband was convicted of attempted murder, he was sentenced to only 1 year of probation. I have to go back to the same apartment, she says. I have to hear the same threats, and I can't do anything about it. Gregory Pfeiffer, NPR News, Moscow.
In the books of the thriller writer Chelsea Kane, the city of Portland, Oregon, is a character, and that character is a woman.
A hot woman. In hiking boots.
A woman with complicated relationships.
She's probably got a little bit of a complex involving her older sister, her big sister, San Francisco, and her middle sister, Seattle.
And as imagined by the author, Portland is one haunted babe. In our continuing series, Crime in the City, NPR senior correspondent Ketzel Levine tours the dark town with the darker still, Chelsea Kane.
This much I know. She likes being noticed, even on this empty beach along the Columbia River. The silk scarf loose around her neck trails her like Dior, poison. Her dark glasses and vamp lipstick are startling as the wind whips her unnaturally honeyed hair.
I started walking here with my mom, and I actually came to Portland when my mom was dying of cancer. That's how I moved to Portland. So right away I had this sort of mixed relationship with the city.
Chelsea Kane may fly her sentences like kites, but she is no dippy dame.
I often, when I'm walking in the wilderness, keep my eye open for bodies. I do. Ever since I was a kid. You know, I think I read too many Nancy Drew books to start, and it went from there. You know, you never know when you might come across a dead body. And the converse of that is to think, well, where is a good place to dump a dead body?
She points to a mound of sand. I know where this is heading. Heartsick. I've read the book.
She'd been strangled and then soaked in bleach like the others. She lay 5 feet from the water's edge, on her back, head to the side. One leg was slightly bent, the other straight, tangled in river weed.
An unholy mess on a stretch of sand and sunshine. Why is Chelsea Kane dreamt a corpse into being here? On Portland's pastoral Sauvy Island, 10 miles west in a twilight zone from urban woe, then it hits me like a pail of you-pick berries. Beauty kills.
People come to Portland, many of them for the quality of life. And yet, you know, every year, people climbing the mountain get killed by avalanches. And I think that there's just a really interesting tension in the fact that there's this incredibly beautiful environment all around us that picks people off one by one.
Frankly, it's a relief to be back in the city. Truth is, it's a little unnerving being alone with Chelsea Kane. Her dark side is as startling as silence on the radio. You see what I mean. The leafy boulevards of downtown Portland are not among Chelsea Kane's crime scenes yet. So far, she's only published the one thriller, Heartsick. But I've a bad feeling. That's why we're about to sneak in where we're not supposed to be.
I feel like somebody's going to come around the corner and bust us.
Just act naturally, you guys.
We're in a club, members only. Gail Hayes Davis got us in. A woman with the looks of a trophy wife and the brains of a school principal.
Thank you.
Certainly.
Turns out, she was one. We're here because this place, the Arlington Club, will figure in Chelsea Kane's sequel, a book no one has yet seen.
The detective at one point and the journalist come and stay here. There's a serial killer on the loose, and they're in danger. So they put them in the Arlington for safekeeping.
Yes, you can't get in without being noticed.
It's like the Berlin Wall. They shoot you if you come across.
No.
Thinking to walk out before getting thrown out, I make our excuses. Next stop, Portland's densely wooded refuge, its name, Forest Park.
Careful. Come on, let's get a pass.
This is where we're meeting a friend of Chelsea Kane's, writer Susie Vitelli, who holds in her hand a cheap, shiny paperback. It isn't. It is. It's Sweetheart, the sequel, and it's due out this fall.
Forest Park was pretty in the summer. Portland's ash sky was barely visible behind a canopy of aspens, hemlocks, cedars, and maples that filtered with the light to a shimmering pale green. The creek hummed and churned. Birds chirped. It was all very lovely, very Walden, except for the corpse.
Something's not quite right about this Susie Vitelli. This much I know. She's no innocent. The woman's too quick to agree that this model train set of a city could contain such evil.
The books that are set in Portland aren't generally in this genre. And so this is sort of breaking new ground. And I think it's helping to broaden people's idea of what's here.
None for the good. That's my take. I see the city's jewel, Forest Park. She and her writing buddy see a graveyard.
I'm sure there are bodies just waiting to be dug up.
Are you serious?
I'm sure.
Bodies in Forest Park? It's 5,000 acres. There are at least five bodies in this park right now.
I would agree.
Oh, please. Bodies. Yet Chelsea Kane won't relent. She dares me to come back with her alone. Tonight, she will hold the flashlight.
Chelsea, put the light on.
Sorry.
We have been here before, but now it's pitch black and we're heading into Forest Park.
Are you scared?
I'm a little uncomfortable.
Hear that creak?
And the air is exquisite. It's not very ominous. So why thrillers?
It was a story, you know? I mean, I love scary stories.
See if we can get up here?
Okay. You lead the way.
Oh, look at this. Somebody was buried alive here.
Oh,
and this
stop
is the
it.
Pipe we're allowed to breathe through. It's okay.
You know how I talked about the bodies in Forest Park? I think we're the bodies that we're looking for.
Okay. I'm going to go down and then I'm going to shine the flashlight up. So I'm going to leave you for just a moment, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
You know, an imagination like this woman's, and you start walking in the park at night with a flashlight, you can understand what she comes up with, even in a beautiful, idyllic place like Portland.
I'll catch you. Whoa! 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 Whoa!
Ketzel? Ketzel Levine? Looks like another reporter vanished into our Crime in the City series. You can find out what happened to Ketzel Levine at NPR.org. By this Friday, we hope to find some correspondent willing to continue this series with a portrait of Joseph Wambaugh, who's a former L.A. cop.
Before I came along, Dragnet and Adam 12 were good public relations vehicles for the LAPD. But they didn't attempt, ever, to tell how the job acts on the cop. The cops in those stories were stick figures.
It's Morning Edition.